and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, one of my colleagues over at The Athletic, Seth Partnow, is here. We're going to dive deep into the Rui Hachimura trade, where he was sent to the Los Angeles Lakers for a couple of second-round picks. And then we're going to jump into other players at the trade deadline that could maybe use a change of scenery here moving forward. Seth, what's going on, buddy?
What's going, Sam? It has been a while.
Yeah, since you've been on this show, I feel like it's been a year. I think that we did what we redrafted a draft. It was the actually might have been this draft.
Oh, was that when I got myself in trouble by saying silly things about Daniel Gafford as compared to Darius Garland? No one is reminding me of that. Don't worry.
Yeah, I think that you did like a crazy thing, like take Daniel Gafford over Darius Garland.
To be fair,
in the middle of Darius Garland's All-Star season, by the way.
It was like at the beginning of Darius. Yeah. And Daniel Gafford, like, you know, being yanked around the Wizards rotation anyway. So,
which still is happening, by the way.
Yes.
Still happening. And speaking of the Washington Wizards,
we might talk about him later, actually.
Yeah, we really might. Let's talk about the Washington Wizards and a deal that they made on, what was that? I guess it'd be Monday in the United States. They traded Rui Hachimura, which is something that it feels like has been in the works now for a couple of weeks, maybe. Josh Robbins reported, along with Shams Charania, that you know it seems like there has been some sort of trade request, basically. And they moved quickly. The Los Angeles Lakers also moved quickly. They acquired Rui Hachimura for 3 second-round picks. One of those picks is a 2023 Chicago Bulls second that actually might end up in the top 40. Like, that might end up being an okay pick. But the other ones are going to be a little bit more questionable in value because they're a little bit further out. So we don't really need to break that down. But getting one good second-round pick, a couple other flyers, feels like pretty good business for Washington. Hachimura, though, obviously is the, you know, the standout guy here. He is an incredibly important player within, you know, Japanese basketball culture. There is an enormous media contingent, or at least I would imagine there still is, and certainly will be now that he plays for the Lakers, an enormous media contingent that follows him around. He's the first round pick in the history of Japanese basketball. And he is someone that has, to this point, not really found his footing as a winning NBA player. There are moments where he scores at a high level. He averages 13 points per game through his 3.5 years that he's played in the league. But a lot of those points kind of come off as empty calories. Do you kind of feel that way, Seth?
Short version, yes.
Yeah.
He's improved mildly at it over his career, but he came into the league as a guy who didn't get to the line a lot, didn't shoot a lot of threes. And it's just it's a tough diet of you know, attempts for a guy to become an efficient scorer. And if you're not going to be an efficient scorer and you're not going to be a volume scorer and you're not going to be a playmaker and you're not going to be a terribly good defender, it's sort of what are you?
So in his case, he's essentially a mid-range gunner. In half-court settings, he's taking 42% of his shots between 6 and 20 feet. For reference, Bradley Beal only takes 40% of his shots between that range. And Bradley Beal is like a noted mid-range specialist, right? Like, this is where Rui is. Like, that's what his game is in the half-court. He can get out and transition and be kind of a freight train when he wants to use his physicality in that way. But he's not quite as impactful in terms of being a mismatch threat as I thought he might be entering the league. But here's the other thing. He's gotten so good at mid-range jumpers that, like, there's real value in it. He's shooting 48.2% between that 6 and 20 feet range. That's, like, one of the best numbers in the NBA. And honestly, like, I kind of just buy it. He looks super in rhythm when he takes those shots. He's very effective, you know, taking a one dribble pull up off of, you know, attacking a closeout, because he also has a really good pump fake. Teams and defenders always fall for his pump fake in a way that is somewhat bizarre to me, but he's effective enough to where, like, you can make it work where that shot is sometimes the best option on the court, but not all the time. And we're going to get some of the other flaws. I'd imagine that you want to bring up the passing, right, Seth?
Well, that, and also as when you list the things that the Lakers need offensively, another guy who can get a decent mid-range look, what would not be high amongst them?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's certainly useful and probably is a floor raiser for their offense. It does make you wonder if they're either there's a mismatch between goals and actions or goals have changed and nobody's told LeBron.
Well, like, so like, let's talk about the Lakers side of this, you know, and I do want to bring up the passing here in a minute and we'll talk about that. But like the Lakers side of this is I really think they just desperately needed to rebalance their roster on some level, right? Like a lot of lineups that the Lakers are playing are three guard alignments where Patrick Beverley, Russell Westbrook, Dennis Schroeder, Austin Reeves, Lonnie Walker, these guys that are all, you know, 6'5" or under, you know, Austin Reeves is the biggest of those guys. Most of them are, you know, 6'3" and under, and, you know, the case of three of those guys. And playing three guard lineups like that is just really, really difficult defensively. Rui is not a great defender, but I think having his size and athleticism out there does just kind of rebalance the roster in a real way. On top of that, we can talk about Rui like in some of his flaws, and I'm sure we'll do that in a minute again, but like the level that he is replacing for the Lakers is very low. Like they are getting sub replacement level production from some of these forwards. Like all due respect to Juan Toscano-Anderson, who I think has done an incredible job of like building out a career for himself for the Golden State Warriors and now for the Lakers, he is probably like a sub replacement level player at the end of the day within their rotation. And he's certainly not a guy that is going to provide much scoring threat. If you look at his usage, if you look at, you know, just pure field goal attempts, even Wenyen Gabriel is another guy like this. Playing Troy Brown at the four, I think often also leads to its own flaws where Troy Brown is, you know, not the best rebounder at the four position. So this team has really, really struggled on the glass this season. So Rui's going to help a lot of things, if only because the level that the Lakers are getting from other guys is just not that high at the end of the day.
I agree with all that, and I still am left scratching. No, I'm still left scratching my head about this deal a little bit or a lot. I mean, first of all, while he helps, is that the best you could do? Is that the best you could do using up these aren't, you mentioned these aren't necessarily great assets, but they're the kinds of things they're chips and they cashed in.
Right.
Probably I would, I think I estimated yesterday that they think this is about an overpay by about 1.25 seconds. Like,
especially
that.
Given that Bulls pick is potentially a top 40 second round pick. Yeah. Like if you're giving up that pick, I probably would have thought just one more pick would have got it done. And by the way, there was a report that said that the price for the Wizards was 2 second round picks theoretically. And then the Lakers, you know, to get it done today, essentially.
And that gets to my the other issue with it from the Lakers standpoint is they just used a big chunk of their matching salary. So it's not just it's in and of itself. Like this is a kind of deal. I feel differently about it if it happens at noon on what is it, the 9th, than I do if it happens at noon on January 23rd. Because you've explored all the other options. You're not passing anything up. Was there a better deal out there? Was it worth an extra second rounder to do this now and foreclose any other moves? When, as we've said, fine, he helps by being a competent eighth man level type player on a good team. I think that's fair.
Yeah, Ben, I think he's a rotational wing.
Yeah, but I just like why does he win you? Does having him for an extra 2 weeks win you enough games to push it over the top of something that is worth foreclosing the the optionality of doing better, aiming higher.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I would also feel differently. I would think this is just like a straight up, like totally fine deal. If it was someone like the Suns doing this, where they don't have limited assets. Like part of this also is that the Lakers have a very limited asset chest to play with. Like there are only so many pieces that they can move in a deal, right? Like they only have the two first round picks they can move. And now they only have, I believe, 4 second round picks left that they can move. That's just not a lot of wiggle room to play with. When Rui Hachimura, like if you're trying to make the playoffs this year, he can't be the last move that you make. Like you still need to do something else. So that's where opportunity cost in what you're saying really comes into play, I think.
I think he can be the last move. He can't be the first move. Like if I you know, he would not be my pick if I just from a positional standpoint, he's more of a 4. So he wouldn't be an ideal pickup, but that level of player, if the Bucks made a move using some of their limited assets to pick up that kind of guy that they thought could help them in the playoffs to finish the team off, that's fine.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of how, what you should be doing. If you're a team that's already at that level, I mean, do the Lakers think they're at that level when they're healthy?
I don't think so. Look, I certainly think the front office doesn't think so. Like maybe the players do, but I think that we have, you know, enough evidence at this point that the front office seems very wary of using their future capital in order to help this team win games, despite my best protestations saying that I think they should do it. Because I think anytime you have LeBron and Anthony Davis, you should be trying to kick all in, if only because down the road, you can just trade Anthony Davis and get back a bunch of your pick capital anyway. So I think that the other part of this, and ultimately why I'm okay with it, because I agree with everything you're saying in terms of opportunity costs. My problem is I struggled to find anyone else that provides that size on the wing that I think could actually end up going for a price tag that works for the Lakers. Like PJ Washington's another player that's, you know, potentially available in a similar situation to Rui, was in that same 2019 draft class, did not sign an extension, potentially maybe could be had at the deadline. I think that he probably gets a first round pick from someone, right?
Yeah, that's fair. I think he's been a better NBA player to this point in his career than
totally.
Than and there's a reason for that.
Jalen McDaniels is another name I came up with. I think honestly he'd be better than Rui for this Lakers team, but I don't know. Like, does he only get 3 seconds? Maybe he's an unrestricted free agent. Like that's one that like that's the only one that I came up with really.
That's actually a low key. Another thing is because he's part of the reason Washington's willing to do this is they, you know, I think they've reached the end of the line. He's going to be a restricted free agent. They probably don't want to be in a situation where they even offer the qualifying offer. And he's like, yeah, sure. Because I
it's $8.5 million.
Yeah. I mean, is he a non-tax, is he a full mid-level player? I don't think so. So he can't, you're off from the qualifying offer. He might just snap it up. So Washington didn't really want that now, but the Lakers have made a bet that it's now hard for them to win, like longer than you know, the rental of this year, because either they gave up 3 second round picks for a guy who they don't need around anymore, or they gave up 3 second round picks for the right to pay him. And perhaps because LA overpay him in 5 months time.
Well, and on top of it too, I think he is the kind of player that tends to get more money in free agency
buckets
than impacts the game. On top of it, and I mean this like in no way disparagingly, in a way like, you know, people take this the wrong way sometimes, but like he's a genuinely relevant player in Japan, and that market is like craving a basketball star. And again, there are real benefits to a team signing Rui financially. Like it is impactful to your bottom line if you sign him to a multi-year contract. You're going to make money off of this.
You're the Lakers and you have LeBron James.
No, I know. That's my point, though. You don't need to do this.
Yeah.
Other teams, but when he hits restricted free agency, other teams, I can see a world saying like, hey, this is a guy that we think still has some upside. Worst case scenario is we make money you know, off of jersey sales, off of X, Y, and Z, right? So there are a lot of factors here to really consider. At the end of the day, the reason that I like this for the Lakers enough to pull the trigger is that I couldn't come up with another option that was this cheap other than Jalen McDaniels, who may or may not be available, right? Like, the Lakers almost certainly did their due diligence on finding out what Jalen McDaniels' price tag is, found that it does not quite compute with what they're looking for, and moved on to other players, you would think, at least, right? So it's hard for me to find that replacement level player. Doug McDermott doesn't really fit like this $5 million chunk of salary that they can use, like, and still maintain Patrick Beverley's deal, still maintain Russell Westbrook's deal that gives them further flexibility out at the deadline. I'm good with this deal for the Lakers. I don't think it really swings anything for them outside of just raising their floor a little bit when LeBron is off the court.
And I think that I don't disagree with you know, the market aspect of it. The question is if this is the best you can do, is it worth doing? That's, you know, and there's the considerations, like LeBron said, make a move. And that's in terms of realities, you understand how that can put the thumb on the scale and make the thing happen. But that's sort of an explanation, not a good reason. From my perspective. So I don't it's hard to hate on it too much, because ultimately, as you said, it's a decent second rounder for a team that doesn't want to play second rounders and some future stuff that doesn't matter to anyone involved on their relevant timeline. keeping in perspective, there's only so the degree to which you can hate the deal is only so much, and it's more sort of a distaste for what it signifies about what they're thinking or what they're attempting to do than the deal itself. It's settling for not much at a slightly inflated price. And it's just like, that's when you're starting a team with LeBron James,
you don't like getting in that.
Spot. And so I guess my distaste for it is as much a commentary on their last kind of three windows that put them in a situation as much as this particular move.
Yeah. My last question for you is, where did you were in the Bucks front office when Rui was in the draft, if I remember correctly, right?
That was the first draft that I was there, and he was.
Yeah.
No, wait a minute. No, that was.
I think you were there because that was the Grant Williams draft, and you really like Grant.
Yeah, yeah. I think he the first draft I was there, he declared and then went back and ended up went back to school for like two more years, if I remember correctly.
He went back for one more year. He declared as a sophomore, I believe, went back to school, and then the junior year was the breakout All American year, where he then just like skyrocketed.
That's right.
Did you like him pre-draft? He seems like the kind of guy that you would have lower than.
Yeah, not really. I just like it's. I mean, the way he profiled as a college prospect is kind of what he's turned into in the NBA, and there are guys of that profile who become good NBA players. I think I might. It's probably harsh to make the comparison, but there was some part of the reason why I didn't love Keegan Murray in the draft. Is there is some of the same thing, but obviously Keegan Murray is a better shooter, is a better defender, better everything, basically. And so he's a guy who's of this profile, who's done the things that have to be done. Whereas, you know, Rui came in, and like I said, he didn't shoot threes, didn't draw fouls, didn't get to the rim very much.
Didn't pass.
Well. It's like, that's a very early 90s power forward profile.
It's a hard needle to thread. He basically had to be a primary scoring option to thread that needle.
Yeah.
And I thought there was some upside there, like physically. I mean, he's 6'8", 230 pounds. Like, when he wants to play physically, he is strong as hell. And he has enormous hands, like a 7'2" wing. Like, you can, like, if you were building like a 6'8" basketball player in a laboratory, like, this is what it would look like. It would look like Rui Hachimura, and it just hasn't quite managed yet. And like, I wonder if some of the passing stuff, for instance, so like you know, I wrote this in the story I wrote, but like he averages like 2 potential assists per 24 minutes played. That's like in the bottom 20% of all forwards in the NBA, essentially.
On my playmaking usage, he's at 3.6, which is among the lower in the league, certainly for forwards. Yeah. That puts him just behind Dwight Powell and Montrezl Harrell.
Yeah, right. So that's who he is. And it becomes tricky, I think, to try and find exactly, you know, what's going to happen when like LeBron kicks out the ball to him and he pump fakes into like a one dribble pull up, like 18 footer. And like LeBron looks at him, he's just like, what are you doing? Like, this is not efficient offense. This is not the way that like things work. But, you know, he can get the shot. That matters. He does score. Like, he's relevant as a scorer. Yeah, I don't know. I actually had him a little bit lower on my board as well. And this comes from someone who I went up to Gonzaga to interview him like before the season. He's one of my favorite people I've ever talked to in my life in basketball. I just wonder if some of his flaws kind of permeate his game because he came to basketball later. Like, he came to basketball at like 12 years old, after like growing up playing baseball in Japan and everything. And I just wonder if like, he is missing that, you know, essential youth time kind of thing. You know what I mean?
A little bit of feel, a little bit of ball handling.
Yeah, exactly. That, like, you know, you get when you just kind of like play at 5 years old, 4 years old, whatever. Like, you just get more comfortable doing it. Okay, let's take. Do you have one more thing?
I think we covered Rui.
Okay. Let's take a quick commercial break. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some change of scenery, guys, at the NBA trade deadline. Okay, we're back. Seth, I came to you with this idea of just breaking down guys that, like, we just want to see in a new place. Right. We just kind of want to see them in a new environment at the end of February. I believe it's February 7th, if I remember correctly, in terms of the exact date, maybe February 8th. We just want to see these guys in a new home. Like, I'm sad watching John Collins play basketball right now, Seth. I need to see him play anywhere else, almost on planet Earth. I would be happy to see John Collins at this point. Do you like John Collins as a player? I'm a pretty big fan for the most part.
On my podcast, it's sort of a running joke that I've tried to trade John Collins to half the league. So, yeah, no, I think there's a lot. Like, I think there's a lot more to John Collins than Atlanta has like gone out of their way almost to use less and less of the things he can do, the offensive versatility, and turn him into sort of just a stand in the corner or just a pick and pop guy. Like, you know, he can play on the move. He can put the ball on the floor. He's not a, I wouldn't say he's a high level passer, but he's a guy who can make plays with the ball in his hands. He's a good finisher. He is a pick and roll player who is probably among the more versatile in the league in terms of the ability to either dive or pop. These are things that can help an offense at a high level. And I think he's improved defensively over the course of his career a little too.
And I'm so glad you said that.
And he, you know, it was 2 years ago, but he also showed like he was willing to be like a garbage man if the team needed that in the playoffs. So you put all that together and you think about where the cap is going. And I don't think his contract is even especially onerous. I think in a situation where he is allowed to, you know, do more than be a floor spacer, you get that kind of value from him.
I think you're 100% right. I love the role versatility. The one thing he can't really do is short roll. Like, he's not really a great short roll to playmate guy, right? He doesn't really recognize that like 4-on-3 advantage that so many, you know, rollers have gotten really, really good at. But
he doesn't get any reps at it.
Yeah, he doesn't have any reps at it. Additionally, he's so good as a vertical lob threat And he is actually like a genuine pick and pop threat. Like he has made up until this season where the shooting has fallen off a cliff for reasons, you know, who knows? Maybe it is just like a change of scenery kind of thing. He's made like 38% of his threes on four attempts per game, which for a big is not bad volume whenever a lot of those shots are coming in pick and pop kind of scenarios. So I do think there's real role versatility there. I do think that there is a lot of latent defensive ability. Like it used to be that he was too slow to guard fours, not big enough to protect the rim at the five. He's gotten in way better shape. He is really, really smart. He actually defends fours now well. He is a good defender at the power forward position. Like not on the level of a Jaren Jackson, not even like on the level of an above average defender necessarily, I would say. He is a solid defender that you can actually trust to have out there in lineups that matter in the playoffs. And I'm so glad you brought up like the garbage time stuff. It seems like he just wants to win. Like everything I've seen from John Collins says that he is the exact kind of guy that I think has just been kind of misutilized, you know, due to roster construction. Like Clint Capela needs to be out there for the Hawks defensively. And you have to use him as the guy in ball screens because he's unusable really in any other circumstance offensively. I really think that if you get John Collins, like if you put him in Indiana and you re-signed Miles Turner, that sounds like an awesome front court combination for Tyrese Halliburton to me. If you put him in Oklahoma City and you put him next to Chet Holmgren, that sounds like a really fun front court combination to me. Guys that can stretch the floor, can play with the ball just a little bit because Miles has improved a little bit, and then also protect the rim. Man, I think he could really, really, really get excellent again if he plays in that kind of scenario.
I mean, we can just start naming off teams. You'd say Utah. You can say there's no mechanical way to make it happen. But Golden State, you can like just, you know, the places where that just works. Are many. Miami, like him and Bam is an interesting front court pairing. So yes, I agree with all that. And it's kind of like there's a reason why he's sort of been on the block for basically two solid seasons. Is I think everyone recognizes this.
Yeah, but it's weird that they haven't found a home for me. Like it feels like they might be overpricing it, but like I don't know. Sam Amick just wrote that like the price isn't that extravagant. He wrote that in the big Hawks, breakdown about their front office and the turnover that has had in recent months. So like the price tag apparently is not even that crazy. And then on top of it, I don't know. Like I feel like maybe he is a guy that like teams don't totally trust in the playoffs. I don't know though. Like I'm pretty good with it.
I mean, it seems like, it's almost like the reputation of his contract rather than the contract itself. Oh, he's got a big deal. It's like, hey, $25 million is, it's not onerous.
It's what those guys cost.
Yeah, it's not onerous as for like a good starter.
Yeah, it's the same with like Julius Randle. Like people were talking about Julius Randle's contract being an overpay, like being terrible.
I'd rather have John Collins.
I think I'd rather have Randle, but I understand your point, and I think there's like a reasonable like case for it. Who's a guy that you look at on the deadline, potentially market, let's say, that you think could use a change of scenery?
I think we put our heads together, and one guy we came up with is Patrick Williams. It's not happening, and it's not again, like it's almost like the mini version, and not in the same way because there's not like one guy monopolizing the ball in Chicago as there is in Atlanta, but
it's a lot of guys monopolizing the mid-range area, which is where I think he does his best work, like in that mid-post kind of like area,
and has never really gotten a chance to expand it because it seems like he has got some like nascent put the ball on the floor skills. And it just there isn't room for him to be in those situations when you've got, you know, DeRozan and LaVine doing their thing and Vooch either posting up or popping or playing at the elbow. I mean, that's just
right.
He gets shunted to sort of the sidelines and the corners.
Yeah, he does. And it's weird, too. Like you look at the shooting numbers this year, 46% from the field, 42% from three, 88% from the line. You look at the shooting numbers over his career. I mean, look, he takes 2.5 threes a game over his career and has only taken 330 of them, but he's made 41% of them. Like, there's a non-zero chance that there is like genuine shooting upside with Patrick Williams. And by the way, he is still incredibly young. Like, he is 21 and a half years old. Like, there are guys in this upcoming draft class, like Chris Murray, for instance. Chris Murray is older than Patrick Williams. Like, there is still so much time, I think, for Pat Williams to figure it out. And we've seen some offensive real like skills. Like, I actually like his offensive game a little bit more than Rui's, because I think that he shoots it a little bit better from three. I actually kind of trust his functional strength and like willingness to like use his like shoulders to like kind of bury someone a little bit more than Rui does. I would love to see, I guess I would say this. I would like to see him either be utilized that way in Chicago, or I would like to see him like go somewhere else. Like, I think there's real upside, and I would like to see him get a chance to showcase that upside.
I agree with that. You start to think about where that opportunity to showcase is, and then you start to be like, ooh, because it's like, is it Houston, Charlotte? Where else are we talking about it? It's like, those don't seem ideal, like, development environments. Yeah. So wondering where the spot is.
Yeah, like, San Antonio is one that, like, I would be really interested to see him there. The problem is trying to find an exact thing that works for them is a little bit tricky. Orlando, I think, is a no. Washington, I think, is a no. They have enough of these guys. Charlotte is actually one that kind of stood out to me. But again, if you're moving Patrick Williams, what are you trying to get back? Are you trying to get back winning pieces now to play with Zach LaVine and DeMar DeRozan? Are you re-signing Nikola Vucevic? Are you like, that's kind of what I'm struggling with, I guess. Like, what would be their plan? I think they need to like decide on a plan first. That's been my thing with the Bulls all year.
I mean, I don't remember if you were, but I think I was definitely advocating for them to move him last year, because that was like the best their team was likely to be in sort of this iteration. And yeah, they got hurt but they could have used a little more depth last year, and he was the piece they had that. And it's, you know, because a year more of kind of minimal development and a year closer to the end of the rookie deal, you just get less for him. And so you do wonder, like, I don't think he's at the stage where you might be with Rui, where it's just like, you know, we're done here.
Definitely not. No chance. Like, I think they would get like a pretty solid first rounder for him if they moved him. Not like I don't know if they'd get like a top 10 potential first rounder, but I think like, you know, 15 to 22. Yeah. Like, I think they would pretty easily get that. But again, like, I don't know if they should move him. I want to see him in a change of scenery that could involve the Bulls. Like, that changing the scenery could involve them making other moves, but I want to see him in a different place. I agree with you. Another guy in the 2020 draft class that I would like to see in a different spot is Obi Toppin. I don't know if you've been paying attention to Knicks games all that much, but the Knicks like have openings in their rotation right now. They have openings for him to play minutes. And for whatever reason, Tibbs is just like, hard pass on Obi Toppin 25 minutes a night, it feels like. And it's frustrating. Like, I think that when he's out there, he's actually super aggressive. He drives transition play at a reasonable level. He attacks in like a real functional way. He's an offensive player that really, really helps. Like, he can actually shoot a little bit now, it feels like. Obviously, he's that incredible vertical threat. And when they play him in the corner a lot of the time, like Atlanta does with John Collins. And this could be a recurring theme, that these guys might be a little bit harder to build around than what we're acknowledging. But I feel like there's more here. I feel like a team that was more willing to creatively use Obi Toppin could actually really make him a really, really interesting player.
A guy whose best skills are motor and movement playing in one of the more static systems.
Yeah.
That's
such a good call. Yeah. It's such a good call. Like you look at his minutes over since he got back. I mean, 8 minutes or 8 games, he's playing 11 minutes a night. And again, there are real openings in their rotation. Yeah. Like it's hard. Like it's not hard to get him moving. It's not hard to like run him in ball screens, run him in slip actions, run him in like ghost screens, run him in,
just let him run.
Let him run. Just go. Get out and go, Obi. I'd love to see him in an up-tempo scheme. I'd love to see him somewhere where he's just going to get like real opportunities to just kind of rock. I mean, it feels like the Knicks drafted him without a plan on how to use him to his best potential.
It's not the first time, but yeah, I think that's right. And it's not hard to find, you know, teams that would be really interesting fits for him. Again, another guy who would be an interesting Warriors player. I think the Suns, there are teams especially that are playing kind of want to play a smaller, more mobile four.
Yeah.
Because he brings, you know, that vertical pop, good offensive rebounding. Shoots it well enough from the corners. You'd like him to be a better above the break shooter, but like again, you put him in a situation where he can work the baseline, you know, for those threes, for those cuts, for those offensive rebounds, and just play it. And again, just be moving all the time, make someone have to keep up with him. I mean, it's a, you know, probably more offensively talented, not as good a defensive player as, but a similar kind of spot to where someone like Jared Vanderbilt would thrive. I mean, not the same skill set, but the same spots on the floor, I think would be useful for him.
Yeah. Like the team again, like if the Pacers didn't want to pay for John Collins, put him next to Miles Turner and put him in that offense where there's so much ball movement, so much movement in general, I think he'd really thrive there. Like, I think he would put up like numbers in that offense. And oh, by the way, if the Pacers like really liked him and really didn't value the 20 to 40 range in this upcoming draft class, kind of like I don't really value the 20 to 40 range in this upcoming draft class, they have a couple of those picks. They could move what I believe they have do they have the Bucks pick? This might be something you can answer. Why do I think they have the Bucks pick? No, Houston has the Bucks pick. They have the Celtics pick at number 30, or they have Cleveland's pick at number 24 right now. Shout out Tankathon for helping me out while I was looking at that. I don't know. One of those two picks for Obi Toppin's like kind of interesting to me.
There might be. I mean, there's the possible interesting trade there anyway. Just like the Pacers are the team where you say you can never have too many wings. The Pacers might have too many wings. Like there's. I mean, Hield is the obvious one, but you figure that in terms of guards and wings, all right, you know, Halliburton's the one. Nembhard and Mathurin look like guys they really want to go forward with. That still leaves you with, you know, Chris Duarte or Shea Brissett. I think Aaron Nesmith has shown a fair amount over the last, you know, month plus.
I agree.
And so that's just, you know, none of those are star players, but they're useful players at a position everyone is always looking for more help.
Yeah, and like Chris Duarte, I wonder if there is just like a Chris Duarte for Obi Toppin swap there. Like Duarte is he's struggling to stay healthy, it feels like, in his NBA career as much as anything. But a guy that is a willing defender, can handle the ball a little bit, a guy that was a knockdown shooter in college and just thus far in his NBA career, especially this year, he's only making 30% from three right now. Made 37% from three last year, though, averaged 13 points and 4 rebounds and 2 assists per game. If they think that like maybe he's just like kind of fallen behind some other guys in the rotation, I wonder if there's like a challenge trade there. Just Chris Duarte for Obi Toppin. And I wonder if like that's interesting.
It's not even really a challenge trade. It's just a rebalancing trade.
For both teams.
Yeah. It's like, all right, well, this guy is blocked on our team. That guy's blocked on your team.
And yeah, maybe the Knicks add like a second rounder because Duarte has the extra year of team control on his contract. I don't know. Like there's something there. I'm kind of interested in that one where that would actually help, I think, both guys a little bit in terms of change of scenery that could be useful.
Or maybe the Knicks take Jalen Smith or something like that because they probably need help with the injuries they have. They probably need some big help now. But now we're trade machining a little too far and going.
We're trade machining a little too far. But I think that something like that could really, really help. And I think that I'm at the point where I'm just kind of done with the Obi Toppin in New York experiment. It just seems like this coaching staff is not going to utilize him to his fullest potential. The other guy that I think fits this, by the way, is Isaiah Hartenstein. That was an offseason signing. You watched him last year with the Clippers, and he would get the ball kind of at the top of the key or at the elbow, and they'd let him play make a little bit and utilize his passing ability and short roll ability, and there's just none of that in New York. This is, again, just like a pure, this signing did not work. There are places where he will work. We've seen it with Los Angeles last year. I wonder if the Clippers would just like come calling and say, hey, we'll give you, you know, a second or something like that, plus whatever salary filler they have, and just go.
Or maybe the Kings as sort of like, okay, if Sabonis has to sit. Wow. Here's the light version of Domas.
I like that a lot, actually. That's awesome. That's really, really good. That's a really good spot. Also, Obi Toppin with the Kings would be really good too. Just as a like go sprint, do stuff kind of guy, given how fast they play. But yeah, I wonder if there's a Kings Knicks move that could happen there. Because Hartenstein, it just seems like it's not going to work because they're not going to utilize his actual skill set at this point.
It is concerning. Like he was a very good rim protector in LA, and he has been not that in New York. And so that is a worry, because if he is a good passing, bad defensive backup center, that makes him almost like the lesserest Plumlee. And
yeah, I think he has a little bit more than like Marshall, at least.
Yeah, that's fair.
No, but like, you know, Mason Plumlee is a guy that I've been advocating for a few teams to trade for, because I think he'd be like a really helpful 18-minute-a-game center for some teams in the regular season, and then maybe like a 9-minute change of pace in the playoffs. But like, you know, Hartenstein does some similar things there.
You're touching on the saddest trombone trade, by the way.
Yeah, I know. We're at the point where we're just getting sad now.
No. It's James Wiseman for Mason Plumlee is the sad trombone trade.
Seth, I've been advocating on this podcast for that for a little while now. Like, it makes a lot of sense. Like, if you're going to move Wiseman before next year because you think that the real reason that it makes sense is because the Warriors, if they move Wiseman's deal before the salary or before the luxury tax kicks in next year, their tax number is basically what it's going to be this year. Even after if they keep Draymond Green, after the Jordan Poole extension, after the Andrew Wiggins extensions, like they can keep their salary books like pretty similar by moving James Wiseman. And if you're going to move him, I'd probably move him this year so that I can get the value that could potentially help me win another title. But I'm not sure that I'm not sure that the front office with Golden State agrees with me.
The politics of the situation might outweigh the basketball of the situation. And it has been thus basically for the last 2 years with respect to Wiseman, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Where do you want to go next? I want to see Eric Gordon just in a different place, because I feel like we're at that point where it would make sense.
This is the when you were chatting about this yesterday when we were setting this up, I think we were discussing a little bit like which player has the most I don't want to be here vibes, and it was it's on the short list between him and OG Anunoby and Zach LaVine, and it's just he's been there kind of marooned for so long, and he hasn't even got like the Al Horford, you can go chill at home. He hasn't even got that going for him. So he's just kind of there and
yeah.
Sad.
I'm not even sure. Like, I don't think OG has those vibes necessarily. I think OG is just kind of a low-key dude. I don't really like it. Everything about the OG situation to me feels like other teams trying to pry him, as opposed to the Raptors. Like, I think the Raptors are happy to listen because he's an incredibly valuable player, but like, I don't think they're sitting there like, oh my God, we, you know, this is our time to cash in. If someone presents them with an offer, I think they would, but yeah.
Do we think that they're at the point where like, okay, Project 6ix9ine or whatever is maybe this was the wrong alley to go down.
Maybe it's hard because like Oklahoma City is doing a very similar thing right now. They're just valuing offensive skills and feel differently than Toronto is. And I think it's working better for Oklahoma City than it is for Toronto right now. And I think that's the key. Like you need guys that can shoot and have really good feel and can like play the Raptors feels like haven't really valued those things as much as Oklahoma City. And I think those skills are essential when you're talking about building a project like this. Yeah. So I don't think it's a wash. I just think that like they need to do a better job valuing those things.
Well, OKC also has just, you know, by virtue of where they are from both a salary cap and like draft capital standpoint, they have vastly more flexibility to remake and fill in the team around them, where, you know, the Raptors are still sort of in the championship hangover.
Yeah.
You know, very locked in from a cap perspective type team, where they to add, they've got to subtract.
Yeah.
And so that almost necessitates, you know, starting to change those pieces. And that, you know, that's why we could see Gary Trent getting moved. Fred VanVleet, his name has come up some. I think Siakam has interested people. I'm not sure that he's actually available.
Yeah, he shouldn't be available. I'll say this, like, I'm still really interested in Malachi Flynn. Like, I want to see him in an offense that, like, actually runs a lot of ball screens and, like, utilizes his skill set to its best degree. And Toronto just hasn't really done that at this point. Like, Malachi is an operator in ball screens. He's really, really sharp, I think, at finding open teammates, at getting his own bucket. Like, he has a really creative handle in those situations. Yeah, he's small, but he fights defensively. Like, look, he's limited in some respect, right? But I don't know. Like, if I was a team that ran, like, a ball screen heavy offense and needed a backup point guard, I would very much try that with him, I think.
I would just be worried that for that, why is it that a team that has just been dying, crying out for guard play for minutes from ball handlers, that he hasn't really been able to consistently, you know, some of his injuries has been some of that for sure, but how come he hasn't been able to seize that?
Oh, I think it's scheme, to be honest, as much as anything. Like, I just don't think the scheme fits him.
Yeah, but, no, there might be, but I'm, you know, what is Nick Nurse seeing in practice every day that you know, he knows this play, he knows him better than any, like, I think there's a little bit of, like, you know, if he was obviously blocked because they were, yeah, you know, they had, you know, a combo guard that was playing, you know, with Trent and VanVleet, and those were soaking up all the minutes. I think it's a different situation than it's just like, well, there's a wide open lane for minutes, and it's just not going to him.
Yeah. And honestly, like we talked, you know, we're talking about the Raptors, like, and maybe it is time for Fred VanVleet to go somewhere else. Like maybe that is an interesting idea. You know, Gary Trent just seems like he is who he is, but like Fred VanVleet is clearly not playing super well right now, and I wonder why that is.
I mean, you do have to worry about sort of tread on the tire there.
Totally.
In part because, you know,
Nick Nurse just runs these dudes into the ground.
Yeah. But if Nick Nurse trusted Malachi Flynn more, then, you know, you know, it's sort of all of a piece there. And maybe it's just Nick Nurse is, you know, Tibbs North.
Hot take?
Yeah.
I don't think he's done a great job this year. I don't. I don't think that's
a particularly hot take, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think Nick Nurse has done a great job. We started this on Eric Gordon. What do you think Eric Gordon actually is at this point? Because it feels like a long time since we've seen him in a competitive environment.
I have no idea. Like, the reason why he was intriguing is that for a not very tall guy, he had the bulk and wingspan to play up. Can he still do that? I don't know. Can he still shoot? Can he still shoot with deep range? Can he still shoot with deep range well enough that a team that would be interested in trading for him could actually get use from it? Is he an improvement on, okay, Pat Connaughton hasn't played great for the Bulls, for the Bucks this year. Assuming he rounds sort of back into form a little bit, how much of an upgrade is Eric Gordon on Pat Connaughton?
I think he probably is an upgrade, if only because of the ability to like put the ball on the floor at a higher level. And like that just can kind of bend defenses and warp defenses. And if the Bucks can do that more often, I think that it only helps them with guys like Giannis and Chris Middleton just trying to find little creases as a driver. But like at the same, I get what you're saying. Like, I don't know.
If you think about just from switching around to think about from the Bucks standpoint, for them to make any real upgrades, probably cost them Marjon Beauchamp.
Yeah. Like to me, the team that makes sense is like Phoenix. Like, do Dario Saric and Jay Crowder for Eric Gordon, and then add a third team in between Houston and Phoenix to find a third landing spot for Jay Crowder, potentially Milwaukee. That could make sense.
I mean, I feel like Crowder is almost the bigger version of Eric Gordon.
Totally.
And, you know, Gordon's was because he could play up. Can Jay Crowder guard threes anymore?
Or
is he just an undersized four now? And, that's sort of what would worry me about him for the Bucks is they don't need minutes at the four. They need guys who can guard, you know, big wings. How do you feel about Jay Crowder guarding Jason Tatum?
Not great.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I don't feel great about anyone guarding Jason Tatum at this point, but like, you know, obviously on the margins is what you're trying to like find answers for, eating up minutes. But yeah, I don't know. That's a tricky one. Do you have anyone else that you want to talk about, Seth?
You know, we mentioned a bunch of guys when we were talking about this, and so many of them have slipped my mind. I mean, we mentioned Daniel Gafford as just a you know,
your king.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I think Kyle Kuzma, I don't know if he needs a new home, but I think he's probably the biggest swing piece.
Yeah.
This year.
I'll say this. I think that the fact that they moved Rui says to me that they might feel good about re-signing him right now.
Has anyone asked him how he feels about that?
Yeah. You know, I would imagine that they have those conversations at the very least, but look, I agree with you. I think he is an incredibly large swing piece that could really help a lot of teams, but I don't know if he's actually going to move or not. It feels like the Wizards never move the guys that we feel like they should move when they're on expiring deals. So I don't know if we should feel confident in that. Another guy that we talked about was Jackson Hayes. Just feels totally blocked right now in New Orleans. And guy with athleticism, guy that can rim run, you know, started for a playoff team last year with the Pelicans. So they figured out how to utilize them, and I think a couple other teams could probably do so too.
I think we didn't leave ourselves enough time. But the guy who for many reasons could possibly use a change of address is DeAndre Ayton.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like his defense has been just much less impactful this season than what it's been the last couple of years, and I don't know. You know, the offense has been fine. Like, he's been able to like take up some of the possessions that they need him to take up, I guess.
Yeah, the fake trade that got floated to me for that is like Nurkic and Hart and maybe some draft stuff for Ayton. I think that's now with Portland kind of
fading a little bit.
Yeah. Like, is it worth doing that, or is that the kind of thing you need to do to kind of pull yourself out of the tailspin?
That's
in terms of like high level players who you know probably would like to see somewhere else. I think that you know, between him and Collins and Kuzma, are probably the main ones. Unfortunately, I don't think any of them are, like, maybe Collins, it seems like it might happen, but that's been 2.5 years where,
yeah,
like, basically from, I mean, it was even like mid season, the year they made the conference finals, even, that he's been on the block since then.
Yeah. It's really crazy. Seth, tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people about, what Dunked On Prime, about The Athletic, about everything you've got going on.
So, first of all, Sam's coming on my podcast. It'll get released tomorrow.
Accurate. On
Colin. Read me on The Athletic. We just published the two of us and Danny LaRue published the trade deadline big board. I'm doing some playback live watch alongs with Mo DeKeel over with the folks at Playback. We did Kings Grizz last night. It was a lot of fun. Think we're doing Bucks Nuggets tomorrow night. We'll see. As you mentioned, I'm Dunked On Prime, providing some stats to Nate and the crew, and doing what we're calling the nerd nosh, just bite-sized bits of analysis a couple, three times a week.
Yeah, wow, that's fantastic.
List it all out like that, it sounds like a lot.
Well, and you have your day job at Stats Bomb, which is also a thing, where you literally run like North American sports, don't you? Know.
So. And I just pitched an idea for my second book, so you know.
Oh my goodness! Go read Seth's book.
Yeah,
come on, give me title, give me everything, Seth.
Oh, it's the Mid-Range Theory. It came out in paperback this fall after it came out hardcover before last season. The paperback includes a new afterword where I talk about all the stuff I messed up.
That's right.
21-22 season.
It's the best.
But why was I wrong is as important as admitting I was wrong, because that's when you get down to it, examining what the process that led to a decision is the important bit. So trust the process.
Totally.
Read the book.
Totally. Go to The Athletic. I wrote a big breakdown of the Rui Hachimura deal. Like Seth said, we have the NBA trade deadline big board. We're going to update that as we kind of go. What else do we have? I don't know. I've midseason all transfer team coming up for college basketball at The Athletic. Go read that. Until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.